So thank you all for attending this session, and please welcome Vilu Husman from OpenScoring.
Okay. So it is my privilege to give the last talk on this fine conference. My name is Vilu Husman, and I want to tell you a little about the internals of machine learning models. For the past 3 years or so, I have been working on a collection of projects which deal with the problem of moving popular machine learning models to production environments. And I have built this connection around a particular standard called the PMML. And using this approach, I have a constant complexity connection. It means that it takes exactly the same effort to move R or scikit-learn models to Apache Spark as it takes to move Apache Spark models into Android apps or to deploy them as standalone REST web services. But before we continue with a more elaborate technical discussion, I want to define a couple of terms. In this talk, when I talk about models, then I talk about functions which take an input data record, perform a computation on it, and then produce an output data record. And when I speak about representation, then I mean a specific way of conceptualizing and implementing models. It's very important to understand that it's possible to have different representations of models. And whatever decision you make, it will determine that what kind of problems you will be able to solve in the long run and how easy your life is going to be. Well, the problem should be obvious to all practicing machine learning people. The problem is that the model training environment and those real-life production systems, they are decoupled from one another. Let's say if you trained your model in R, but you want to deploy it in database, or to make things worse, you might want to integrate this model directly into your web application. Well, there are many possible solutions to this problem, and today I am talking about my take on it. So this is a solution, this is not the solution. And my solution is about taking those raw models and converting them into a stable representation, which we can be sure that we will be able to work with also 5 years in the future. And once we have attained this kind of stability, then we can start building all sorts of automation mechanisms around it. And in this case, for example, we can start building automated translators into SQL code or into JavaScript or whatever you need in the future. And as mentioned in the first slide, the standard that I chose to work with is called the Predictive Model Markup Language. This standard is close to 2 decades old, and it is maintained by a consortium of major data mining and statistics software vendors. The problem with this standard has been all the time that there were no easily accessible implementations of it. And so in some sense, my work was like the first usable implementation of this standard for the Java people. And if you are wondering if this standard is applicable to your use case, then I can assure you that it can handle most popular model types, starting from simple regressions and ending with complex deep neural network topologies. once we have made the decision to use a particular standard, then the goal becomes to make it accessible to end users. And in this case, I tackled this problem by building a sequence of API layers on top of it. The bottom API layer is concerned about reading and writing those model objects. The next API layer gives you the ability to statically query this model data structure. For example, you will be able to find out that what are the names and types of model input and output fields. On the next level, there is an API for executing those models with actual data. And then there are further layers that, for example, make it possible to trace individual predictions. For example, if you want to see that which features contributed to the decision or what else. Again, a very important point about applied machine learning is the understanding that you are dealing with two separate concerns. During model training, you are dealing with a huge body of data, and your task is to find a function that approximates this data body the best. However, during the model deployment, you just want to take this model and apply it to new data points. And in most cases, those data points, they may be coming in one by one, and you want to take the decision as quickly as possible, preferably in real time. The problem with those machine learning frameworks is that they cannot operate on real-world feature spaces. It means that before you can apply a machine learning algorithm, you have to transform this feature space first. And this is typically exemplified by the way how scikit-learn and the Apache Spark assume you to one hot encode categorical features. So instead of a single string column, those scikit-learn and Apache Spark algorithms, they will be seeing a sequence of numerical columns. But once you want to take this model back to deployment, then this kind of intermediate transformation step becomes a huge burden. For one, it loses information, and it makes the model interpretation much more difficult. So if you want to have a persistent representation of your model, then you should aim to undo or reverse this temporary feature space transformation step so that your model would be expressed in terms of the real-world feature space. I have taken this approach one step further, and I also suggest that once you have successfully exported your model, you should also think about refactoring it. I guess everybody agrees that refactoring your application source code is a good idea. So why do not we apply the same principle on our models? On some of the following slides, I will show you some very obvious examples how you can make typical scikit-learn and Apache Spark models more compact and more performant. And for the rest of my talk, I will be drawing some comparisons between those three popular machine learning frameworks. The first comparison is about the persistence options that you have. I would argue that none of those three frameworks has really solved this problem because they only give you the opportunity to make a binary dump of your model. But the problem is that this blob is coupled to a specific version of your framework, and there are no easy-to-use tools to see what's inside those blobs. For example, there is no easy-to-use tools to parse those R or pickle files let's say, from Java. Admittedly, some of the frameworks already have a built-in interoperability with the PMML standard, but I would generally advise you against using those because they are rather incomplete and some of them also have some quality issues. So if you are like interested in doing the conversion, then you should definitely check out what I have published. And let's say if you are worried that perhaps the conversion to PMML is somehow difficult or requires you to learn new concepts, then I want to assure you that this isn't so. It's basically a matter of importing a conversion library and then invoking a conversion utility method with the fitted model object. In scikit-learn case, you will provide the fitted model object, but you also have to provide a description of this intermediate transformation step that I talked to you about. And you represent this intermediate transformation step using a data frame mapper class. For example, on this slide, this data frame mapper explains how this original 10-dimensional input space was expanded into a 48-dimensional feature space that scikit-learn could adopt. And the good thing is that this conversion utility method is smart enough to play back those transformations in reverse order. So that if you take a look into the resulting PMML file, then you will see that this model is expressed in terms of those 10 original data dimensions. In case of Apache Spark, you do not need to deal with an explicit feature mapper object because those transformations, they are nicely included into this fitted pipeline. But you do have to provide the description of the data frame in the form of its schema. The conversion utility uses this schema information to get the correct column names and their types and all sorts of metadata, such as nilability information. And in case if you're wondering how easy it would be to use those PMML models for scoring on Apache Spark, then this slide could convince you that it's basically a matter of writing 5 lines of application code. You take your PMML file and create an evaluator instance based on it. And then you can use a builder pattern to configure an appropriate Apache Spark transformer instance. And once you have this transformer instance, then you can transform your data sets as usual. Well, the lesson about feature spaces in general is that R is very different from the other two. And it's basically finding the right trade-off between the complexity of, or how easy it is to develop this machine learning algorithm and how easy it is to scale up for larger data sizes. For example, R operates on feature spaces that are pretty close to the real world one. But as a result, it's pretty difficult to write those R machine learning algorithms and your scalability options are also pretty bad. Whereas in scikit-learn and Apache Spark, everything is transformed into a numerical representation. Well, the data set expands a little, but well, this is no problem in the long run because we are able to distribute our computations across a cluster. From the PMML point of view, it needs to be pointed out that every model is accompanied by a so-called of applicability domain information. Basically, it's about encoding the valid value space of each field and also giving the approximation of the value distribution in the training set. And you would use this kind of information to statically check if this model is applicable to your new data set or not. The idea is that you do not want to apply a model to a data set that is not compatible with the assumptions that were used by the data scientist while training it. Because if you violate this principle, you will be getting nonsensical predictions which lead to bad business decisions later on. And in this segment, I will look more deeply into decision tree models. The general comment is that those three popular machine learning frameworks, they train pretty primitive decision tree models. And when I say primitive, I mean that they are only computing splits on single features, and those tree structures, they only do like binary splits. Well, most people don't care, but if you actually import this native model object into this PMML representation and start analyzing it in your text editor, then you will surely find many ways how you can make this original decision tree more compact and more performant. And I would argue that you can make sense of this kind of tree representation without needing any external documentation. Basically, in PMML representation, you have a hierarchy of node elements, and inside each node element, there is a predicate element which encodes the condition that has to evaluate to true for this particular path to be selected. And in the next three slides, I will show you a couple of optimizations that you can apply to those raw decision tree models. The first trick is like very obvious. It's about replacing hierarchies of binary splits with a single level multi-split. And like I said, there are APIs, so when you rearrange your tree, you can be absolutely sure that the rearranged tree stays functionally identical to the original tree, so there is like no risk of corrupting your decision process. The second optimization is about cutting the number of terminal leaf elements in half. And those terminal leaf elements, they are the most numerous in your model, so it's very easy to achieve big memory savings this way. And in case of PMML, this optimization is basically achieved by flipping the value of one attribute at the top level tree model element level. And another optimization is about completely throwing away these parts of the decision tree that do not contribute actively to your prediction. For example, if you are dealing with classification type decision tree models and you only care about the predicted class label and not about the associated probability distribution, then you can just throw away those pieces of the decision tree that have the same class label and only give you a more accurate probability distribution. And here's a probably very intriguing comment, because my experience shows that if you want to improve the performance of your decision trees, then you should really focus on refactoring their structure. Because by compacting and streamlining those predicates, you can easily achieve something like an order of magnitude improvements. Whereas simply by trying to translate those tree structures into application code, well, you may get some improvement, but more often than not, this is actually going to lead into more trouble. Because, well, imagine if you need to translate a several gigabyte random forest file to Java source code and then compile it and deploy it on a JVM. And here is another list of common mistakes that are made when transferring decision tree models from one runtime to another. And the common theme is about violating the precision of those splitting criteria. For example, if the original model was trained using 32-bit floating point splitting criteria, and then you decide to move it to a 64-bit platform, then, well, unfortunately, some of your decisions will not be reproducible. For example, this is the reason why you cannot take scikit-learn and xgboost decision tree models and convert them to the JavaScript, because, well, JavaScript does not have this 32-bit data type. Well, the same observations apply to regression models. Well, the idea is that if you want to get more expressive regression models, then you have a better chance with R, because scikit-learn and Apache Spark are all about scaling to big data sets, and so they have to compromise on the complexity of models. And PMML gives you two top-level elements for representing regressions. The first element, I would say, is intended for human consumers, because it has a very rich vocabulary for representing different regression terms. For example, you have a separate element for continuous features, categorical features, and interactions. There is another representation of regression models, and it's more about dealing with a larger number of predictors and doing more complex computations. Well, when I said that it's probably not a good idea to bother with code generation for decision tree models, then I definitely encourage you to consider this as a good option for getting the maximum performance out of your regression models. And starting from PMML, we can generate this kind of Java application code in a completely automated way. And I would argue that this application code is easily readable also for business analysts. For example, for each categorical feature, there will be a separate method which makes the contributions of each category level like very easy to follow. So you will see that, let's say, over time, how the contribution of each category level changes, or perhaps if they flip sign. And as a general summary, I don't think that I managed to convince you with this presentation that you should go and start experimenting with PMML in your production systems. But you should definitely consider it as a new and interesting tool in your toolbox, because using this different representation of models, you are able to attack a wide variety of problems that you cannot solve in any other way. For example, if you need to see what's going on inside your scikit-learn or Apache Spark model, then I would definitely suggest you to export it into this PMML representation and take a look at it in your text editor. Okay, that's all for me. Do you have like any interesting comments, observations, or maybe you want to like share how you deal with this kind of model analysis in your organization?
I don't think it will be that much interesting, but I was curious about your observation about 32-bit to 64-bit. You observed that, hey, you have to be careful about switching these systems because, well, you might have some cutoff. But if your system is so fragile that this one digit on place 22nd can influence your model and make it worse, then I'd argue that perhaps it's not the best model if it's so fragile.
Well, it's not my system that is fragile. It's, let's say, it's Apache Spark that is fragile, because when those split values are computed, mm-hmm. this is computed as the median value of this feature in the training data set. And this split value is recorded with the precision of this one unit of least precision. Mm-hmm. And by switching the data type, this can cause, mm-hmm. well, the change yeah. is bigger than one ULP, so you will be just simply falling to the other side of this curve.
Yeah, but it's not the fault of the Apache Spark, it's just that the model is not good enough, right?
Well, yeah. this is a general yeah. critique of those okay. how those splitting criteria are chosen and evaluated, mm-hmm. because the same problem, it happens with all machine learning frameworks. But well, it's not manifested if you train using 64 bits and deploy using 64 bits. It's well manifested if there is like 32 to 64 or in the opposite direction.
Well, it's not really a question. Sorry, it's not really a question. But you requested to comment how other companies deal with parsing trees, and I was responsible for that. So, specifically in scikit-learn, it's quite easy to walk those trees, and you can get all the thresholds. It's sort of, I don't know, you can get the gene reductions quite easily as well. And then it's actually quite useful for debugging sometimes. If you know that the feature is broken, some of your thresholds stop making any sense at some level. But yeah, we didn't dump this into XML to achieve this. You can just do it in scikit-learn.
Yes, scikit-learn has like a number of third-party libraries and projects that have built those textual export capabilities. For example, again, translating decision trees to application code. But as one of my comments was that the original scikit-learn decision tree, it has like a very low information density in some sense, if we can express ourselves this way. So if you translate it directly to application source code, then you will get simply a huge source code file. But if you had an option to like to refactor this decision tree first and then generate the code, then you would get, let's say, at least a smaller source code file. And probably this smaller source code file is more efficient to execute.
So have you used PMML as well in the past? Thanks for the JPML library. It's been very useful for me. My question to you is, PMML is XML, and it gets really robust when you have very complex models that you need to train on, and XML can get really huge. So is there a support for EFA?
Well, I don't think I don't think that this size in itself is any kind of argument, because you can compress those PMML files and they, well, yes, they shrink at least 10 times if you apply this regular. But regarding this comment about PFA, I have like I knew that this question was coming, so I prepared the slide. So, but, well, like I said, it's about making a decision that how do you want to represent your models. And I would say that on this axis, from more generic to more specific, PMML is more generic, and PFA is more to the middle ground. So it, well, we can look at it this way, that PMML is about marking down data structures, but in PFA you also have some coupling to this application logic. And I like PMML because this is purely about data structures, so it's very easy and convenient to build those data access APIs on top of it. Well, you can imagine that it will be pretty difficult to parse this PFA document and start doing those similar optimizations on this thing that you have there. But, well, like I said, this is just one way of attacking this problem, and I would say that this PMML is good enough for 80% of use cases right out of the box. And if you apply some thinking, then you will be able also to address a pretty good deal of this remaining 20%. Because, well, in this, let's say, in this regular business environment, well, most users derive their value from simple regressions and decision trees. So anything beyond that is often just not necessary.
Quick question about decision trees, and specifically differences in implementation between R and the Planet's implementation in Spark and the Random Forest implementation in Scikit. I don't know which R libraries you're using in general, but I think that it's a diverse ecosystem, so it's hard. I assume you're using sort of Random Forest for like the decision tree algorithm and XGBoost for gradient boosting, but maybe not. But I guess my question is, for those decision trees, you point to differences in terms of multi-way splits simultaneously, and I wonder, won't the binary implementations split in order if those are like the most reasonable splits to make, sort of the best for the data? And are there like important differences in accuracy as well as in runtime between R, Scikit? I think comparing it to the Planet's sort of distributed implementation may be more difficult, but I'm wondering, do you see differences in accuracy from those differences in implementation?
I don't think, the question was if, let's say, if this, if, well, if the, let's say, if the performance of this decision tree model is somehow related to its internal structure. Did I get you right?
Yeah.
So in a sense that maybe using this binary splits, you can...
Yeah, if you have multiple splits over the same feature at one point in time, will that actually lead to a better accuracy than doing a binary split, but maybe doing multiple splits in a row on that feature if that happens to be what maximizes your Gini coefficient or entropy or whatever it is that you're using?
Well, I tend to think that this is exactly the equivalent code, and probably if we... Let's say if we did this kind of experiment that we generate Java code for those binary splits and Java code for multi-splits, and if this logic is easy enough to follow, then I tend to think that perhaps even, let's say, JVM or JIT compiler is somehow able to reorganize those.
So not a performance question,
conditions.
But an accuracy question. That is, is there a difference in accuracy from the difference in implementation?
I don't think it affects accuracy in any way. It's, I guess those scikit-learn and Spark library developers made the decision to go with binary splits because, well, it just gave them the most compact data structure. Well, because... Yes, they just wanted to minimize, or let's say there are very effective algorithms for, you know, moving around in a numerical matrix if you know that this is definitely a binary split thing. And if you have like multi-split, then you need to have all sorts of offsets and to seeks back and forth, and so it gets complicated. But if you are like interested in long-term stability, then I would say that the choice to go with the binary split is like a premature optimization. So we should like use the representation that is most informative for humans in the long term, because we can like always switch back to this binary split if needed.
Yeah,
and we can like store all those intermediate representations, so it doesn't mean that this original representation is somehow lost. We have just a different view of the same artifact.
Okay. One quick question about PMML in R. Since there are a number of different libraries for different algorithms, is the support equivalent, or are you just sort of doing a general average across that ecosystem? Are you pointing to the Caret package or GLMNet or Enforce or whatever it is that people tend to use? I guess I wonder, like, for which packages is support good and bad, more specifically?
Which framework do you...
So when you're in R, like, there will be many different libraries that you use for machine learning. And I guess I'm wondering, when you talk about R, like, what are you actually pointing to? Like, which libraries are you pointing at?
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with R is that the R core itself is pretty small. And all this interesting functionality is provided in the form of third-party packages. And if you want to achieve this PMML interoperability, then basically for each package, there has to be a separate converter. But the good news is that, well, the number of those popular and useful R packages is pretty small, so it's easily doable even for one person to build all those necessary converters.
Oh, okay. So they already exist and work well for the packages that matter? Okay. So since they're small, can you name them? Like, which packages are you talking about?
Well, the comment about industry versus academia is that, well, if a package is coming from academia, for example, the Random Forest package is a good example. This is like a...
Leo Bryman at Berkeley.
Yes. This is like the implementation of the classical algorithm. But if you actually try to use it or to apply this Random Forest package on a big data set, then you will discover that its performance is quite horrible. So that's why you have like alternative Random Forest packages in R that... can, you know, can do those bigger data sets in a reasonable time. And for example, in this R2 PMML conversion package, there is support for this Random Forest, but there is also this Ranger package, which is another quite popular R package for doing Random Forests. And if you do the performance comparison between Ranger and Random Forest, you will see that Ranger is like several orders of magnitude faster because it has pieces of it written in C and C++.
Okay, and so I guess the comments about PMML support mm-hmm. are, like, well, there will be a package like Ranger and it'll have support. And so when
yes.
you talk about the R ecosystem, it's just sort of in general, it's mm-hmm. relatively better or worse than okay.
Well, if you have like any specific R package in mind which is not yet supported, just open a feature request, and it's basically takes about a day or two to implement this conversion functionality.
Neural network models, are they supported by PMML today? Neural networks?
I lost the part of the question. It was about versions, but...
Sorry, I'm just talking about the PMML spec. Does it support neural network models now? It did not, at least 2 years ago when I checked.
Well, there are new model types being added in each new version. And for example, the latest version that came out this summer added two new top-level model types. And for example, one of those model types was about those, well, you can do those hidden Markov models.
Yeah.
At least, well, you couldn't do it in the previous version, but starting from this summer, they are there. And well, it's possible to build a nice API for working with those data structures, and so all the possibilities are open now.
And are you aware of anyone using PMML for recommender systems for recommending?
Well, I guess recommenders is a one big area which does not fit into this paradigm very well. So if we have those ALS models, then, well, we could probably define some PMML data structure that captures this logic, but I'm afraid it wouldn't be very efficient. For example, I know that Sean Owen has some workaround in his Oryx project where he uses PMML to store those ALS models, but
he's
using also some sorts of workarounds to deal with the limitations of the spec.
He's storing them as PMML extensions. Yeah, I'm familiar with the project. I worked with him on that. And he's storing them as PMML extensions, the ALS models, in compressed format.
We have like 8 minutes if anyone wants to have any question or.
I just want to say thank you for working on JPMML. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And I hope we can get better PMML export into Spark someday. But thank you for your work.
Yes, I would just, maybe I should like make a comment that I said that I have been working on those projects pretty much on my own for the past 3 years, and so I also had to like to invent the business model that would allow me to do it full time. And well, it's also like very nice to have today in this audience a person who actually helped me to kick off all this ecosystem something like 5 years ago. Because, well, if he hadn't pushed me, then actually none of this code would exist today. But again, commenting about my business model, then I'm doing all my work under a GPL license. So it's, if you're looking for an Apache license thing, then there will be slight inconveniences for you. And this is also one of the reasons why I have my own Spark to PMML conversion project, that this code is not part of the Spark code base, because, well, this is purely a matter of licensing thing. Well, maybe one day I will be able to like to revise my licensing model, and well, so this code can be like included into where it really belongs.
So I think that is. Thank you all for attending this session, and thank you again for our speaker for the great presentation.